This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Bellett, where you can catch the boy wonder on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me. Today we're going to continue our discussion about investigation, research on the events of 9/11. Today we have as my special guest an activist and a researcher and a student of the history of research on 9/11, and I thought it would be most interesting to have him on the show. I know him only from emails that he has posted, but then that's appropriate given that Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which I founded, is a virtual society, essentially an electronic entity, wouldn't exist if it weren't for email and the Internet. So I'm very pleased to welcome as my guest Jeff Strahl. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
Now, Jeff, I know so little about you. Why don't you give us a little background sketch, okay, and tell us how you got into all this stuff in the first place.
Sure. Well, I got a degree in mechanical engineering from City University of New York in 1970.
Okay.
Did a brief stint as a corporate engineer and didn't like it. Found myself actually eventually winding up as an instructor in math for UC Berkeley, which I'm still doing. And I became a political activist shortly after graduation. This was in the early 70s and still am.
And that was in relation to the war in Vietnam?
In relationship to the war in Vietnam,
yeah.
To the environment, which we already started seeing as getting destroyed even back then.
Interestingly, by coincidence, yeah. I did a year of graduate work at Columbia, 68-69.
Uh-huh. Cool. You're right up down the street from me.
It was a very interesting year.
Sure.
Berkeley's a high-powered outfit. I mean, math is one of their strongest areas, math, logic, all those formal subjects.
Uh-huh. And math underlies both the physical sciences and engineering.
Of course.
And architecture. So.
Of course.
I mean, these things would exist anyway, of course, without math, but they would be so much harder to express certain things and understand certain concepts without the mathematics.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got drawn into 9/11 research, which may be the beginning of your story about the history of the movement.
Right. Yeah, definitely. This was, on 9/11... like many people, I just suddenly found out while in the shower listening to the radio, and there was a report that buildings were hit. And then I was pretty much completely, numbed by the whole experience, so much numbed that I couldn't even think straight. I was like, heavens, look what's going on. The towers have been fought. This is a terrorist attack, and the people who run this country have caused this to happen. People got mad at us and they did it to us. And I didn't even look at the details. So a few details were available and we were being bombarded by one image after another. But even by evening, I started suspecting something isn't right here. And I remember talking to a friend of mine the next day and mentioning the idea that, maybe the Mossad did it.
By the evening of 9/11, you already had serious doubts.
By the next day.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Can you explain some basis, what it was that struck you about the situation that raised your suspicions?
Well, it was this context in which this was happening. Just a few weeks before 9/11, there was a major protest against globalization at the G7 conference in Genoa. And it was the first time the protesters were actually killed by police action. And it really felt like in the world there was the crisis which has afflicted the global capitalism was really coming to a head. And it seemed just too convenient for this to happen. And the way in which it seemed like the media was already swinging into action as if they were ready. There was something about it that just didn't ring true. And I couldn't really place my finger on it.
Of course, it was one of those astonishingly convenient occurrences. It was like the death of Senator Paul Wellstone during the election of 2002. It just happened to turn control of the Senate over to the Republicans. Just astonishing.
Exactly. But interesting thing, I found out only recently from going through my files preparing for this that the afternoon of September 11th, somebody had sent in an email to topica.com by the name of David Ruschick. he was questioning the whole notion of what happened at the WTC. He was saying you can see the planes hitting and then creating fires, but the fires burn up and then they go out, and then suddenly the buildings collapse, and collapse without, you know, just coming apart completely. How could this, something is really fishy is going on.
That's really good. You know, that's just wonderful to hear that, that somebody could look at that original stuff and just see that so clearly.
Uh-huh. And 2 days later, Peter Mayer of Serendipity, where I found this article, he informed me about it, wrote a piece about the WTC, which he's edited, he's redone several times since then. You can still, you can find the most recent edition if you go to serendipity.li. And also within a couple of days, David McGowan at the Center for Informed America was raising questions about what happened at the Pentagon. Michelle Chrysadovsky was raising questions about the CIA connections of bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Jared Israel was calling at Emperor's Close, was calling into question the stand-down, the apparent lack of response by the U.S. military.
And were you fascinated that the FBI already had a list of suspects before noon?
Yes, that was interesting.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet their names are on no passenger manifest. They have no evidence of any tickets being purchased by any of these individuals. A friend of mine says, so what did Osama do, you know, from his cave in Afghanistan? Put this on his MasterCard?
Yes. This came up pretty soon afterwards. Gary North actually posted an article at Global Research about the passenger lists. And then Michael Rupert, of course, was calling into question the options trading and matters of foreknowledge. But this was also the first instance of gatekeeping within the movement, because 2 days after 9/11, even though very few people were raising questions about what happened at the WTC, he posted an article saying all these reports of bombs going off are complete bunk. My ex-wife was in the Bronx nearby, which it's actually not nearby, and she can tell me that, she assures me that whatever they're saying about it is totally true. And the official story at that point was that the heat of the fires actually caused the towers to melt and collapse. So even though very few people were questioning the official story, he already saw it necessary to tell people to not go there, which is interesting.
Who was saying that?
Yeah. Mike Rupert.
Michael Rupert was telling people not to go there.
Yes.
You know, I found it very curious that his research on 9/11 ignores the physical evidence. I mean, the physical evidence has to be the most important.
Well,
he constructs a case for Dick Cheney's complicity, especially as the mastermind or the executioner here, but he does it while ignoring or denigrating the physical evidence. I find that very puzzling.
Well, I'll get into that later, because that keeps coming up through the history of the 9/11 movement. And then there are people like Steve Gray who were questioning, posting some very interesting questions about the time. And Rupert, of course, then brought up the Grand Chessboard, the interview with Zbigniew Brzezinski, which lays it quite clear that why the motives for 9/11.
Yes, published in 1997, even before the project for the New American Century.
Right. Yeah, prefigured that project. And then Jay McMichael.
Hang on. Hold that thought, Jeff. We'll be right back with my special guest, Jeff Straw, discussing the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Jeff Straw. We're talking about the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement, and especially early reactions to 9/11 by some rather astute individuals who were perceiving more clearly then what many Americans have yet to figure out. Please continue, Jeff.
Okay, so then there was an article by Jay McMichael, Muslims Suspend the Laws of Physics, which got me very interested from a scientific view sense, if not in addition to the implications. Needless to say, I mean, this was my education, after all. And he raised some serious questions about the explanation of how the WTC towers came down. At the time, I was working with this ultra-left group that I've been working with actually for years, and I was trying to bring up questions about 9/11, and they didn't even want to hear the idea that the U.S. government even permitted things to happen. Their excuse was, oh, this is going to do damage to our credibility if we go around saying things like this. This is just conspiracy theory. So I started we broke apart over this, and I got together with some people in the Bay Area who were interested in 9/11. We actually went to see Mike Rupert together and became more of a coalescent group. A really close friend of mine wrote an article about left denial on 9/11. His name is August West. And another friend named Max Kolskig wrote 9/11, a provocation by U.S. capitalism. And all these things were actually starting to get out. And there was a counterattack to that, a very intense counterattack mounted by left icons such as Norman Solomon, Noam Chomsky, Chaco, who is very influential in indie media, basically to the idea that this was completely undermining the left and making people forget about legitimate questions and diverting them towards the dead-end channels. And as a result, Bob Feldman, an activist from New York, wrote a series of articles about foundations and the way they're influencing so-called alternative media. Much of this can be found at a great site that my friend Shu Hung runs called leftgatekeepers.com. About this time, which was spring 2002, Thierry Messon of France started raising questions about what happened at the Pentagon, particularly since there are no signs of a Boeing 757 or any other large airliner in the area. The holes are kind of small, rather small. There are no plane pieces on the lawn either. So what happened here? And John Judge, who had been active with the Kennedy assassination movement and others, he was quick to step into the 9/11 skeptics movement, but he was also quick to start yelling about, oh, these people are telling you that a plane didn't hit the Pentagon. They're just out to discredit the movement. They're either idiots or they're actually working for the government. And he was telling people once again to not go there. Later on that year, a bunch of stuff came out on the physical evidence. People like Jeff King and Gerard Holmgren. Jeff King particularly wrote about the WTC, Gerard Holmgren about the Pentagon, and more from Peter Meyer and David McGowan. And there was a really interesting article by some person I've never figured out who, under Guardian Nerd Cities, which was a very detailed analysis from an engineering viewpoint of everything that happened with the WTC and the impossibility of the story as it happened, and the only possibility being demolition.
Tell me a little bit about Gerald Holmgren's role here. I was not involved in these early stages, so I find a lot of this extremely interesting, and for me, a lot of it new information.
Right. He wrote two pieces. One of them was he went through all the supposed witnesses who saw a plane flying into the Pentagon and found, for the most, hardly any of them actually saw a plane hitting the Pentagon. The ones who claimed to, there are extreme inconsistencies in their accounts, and in many cases inconsistencies with the laws of physics, such as, for example, a plane dragging its wing along the lawn, which didn't leave any gouges on the lawn, and the plane couldn't drag its wing along the lawn. It would flip. So there were witnesses who claimed to have seen that. There were witnesses who claimed to have seen the plane go into the Pentagon. Others who claimed that the plane hit the Pentagon and bounced back. And then he did analysis of physics of the Pentagon, and it was quite obvious that a 757 couldn't have caused the damage that was seen at the time. So that was his first appearance on the scene. He also was among the first to raise questions about the timing of the Pentagon. Since then, he's gone on to play, you might say, a very controversial role, which, you know, that in terms of how I see things with the 9/11 movement. Some of it has really been good, some of it is not. And what about...
Was any of this making any impact in any way, shape, or form, or were we just seeing, you know, sort of nascent websites start to develop, email exchanges and so forth? I mean, what kind of manifestations were taking place of interest in this?
Mostly it was on the Internet. Yeah, there was very little manifestation in the media. The media, for the most part, ignored it. Even the alternative media were very determined to ignore it. There was one exception, which was a local radio show, Bonnie Faulkner, who does Guns and Butter.net, And she has a show on the local Pacific outlet, KPFA. She was really about the only voice on the local media that had people, that had regular interviews with people regarding the events of 9/11 from a critical perspective. Otherwise, the media, both left and right, shunned this topic. But it was very slowly percolating out to the public. Then in 2003 came a GN, Guerrilla News Networks project, Aftermath, which played to a lot of audiences, but what is in many ways what we you might call a limited hangout. It only raised questions about the stand down and foreknowledge, completely shunning the physical evidence. And in fact, several of us were driven to write a critique of it because of that and handed it out at its premiere showing in San Francisco and in Berkeley. This, at the, about the same time, I met a fellow named Jim Hoffman, who I never heard of before, who it turned out was doing a lot of research about the WTC, and he did some very marvelously detailed work regarding the temperatures at which fuel burns.
Hold that thought, Jeff. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest today, Jeff Strahl. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays, Fridays, and occasionally subbing for me. My special guest today is Jeff Strahl, who's a longtime student of the 9/11 movement, a kind of historian as well as an activist and a most interesting fellow. Jeff, we were picking up with your history of the development of study of 9/11 with the work of Jim Hoffman.
Correct. And Jim Hoffman did remarkable work on the World Trade Center, and I still have to give it to him as much as I have serious disagreements with him today. In the process of talking with him also, I decided to get in touch with Jeff King, also known as Plague Puppy, to commend him for an article that I saw by him on Indie Media, which I had a hard time finding. Before I knew it, I was on a list that he had gotten together of people who were researching this topic, which included Hoffman as well as Gerard Holmgren, Webb Ferry, Rosalie Grable, and Nico Haupt, and other people. And we're exploring all sorts of questions there, not just about the WTC and the Pentagon, but furthermore works by such as Professor Keith Dudney, a computer science professor from Canada who had raised serious questions about the use of cell phones on 9/11, given that cell phone calls from high altitude were pretty much very hard, and yet so many of them were made without any difficulty, which was, you know, seemed to be a seriously flawed notion. He also raised questions about how the planes were really taken over, if there were planes, that the planes may have been hijacked remotely rather than by hijackers. He was also assisted by Brad Miu, a communications engineer, who has done some excellent work about the whole cell phone question. And a group of us had formed a subdivision of 9/11 Truth called San Francisco 9/11 Truth. And some of us were trying to raise questions about the physical evidence, and we're meeting just incredible resistance. One person particularly told us that raising physical evidence is anti-working class, since working people don't understand physics and have to raise it.
I think that's quite ridiculous. I mean, working people know the law of the lever. They're quite used to moving masses, for example. If you're talking about people, I even one summer worked as a ditch digger for the Light and Power of South Pasadena between high school and college.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, you acquire a certain practical understanding of physics. I don't think anyone who's used to doing physical things would be remotely impressed with the government's explanation about 9/11. They probably just haven't had the time to ponder it.
Once you point out certain things, about that time I actually started doing an information table about 9/11, which I still do today at the Saturday Farmers Market, which happens in Berkeley. And initially I had people come up and just argue with me strenuously the government story, and then I'd point out certain things, and you could actually see a transformation. In some cases, people couldn't handle it and just walked off, not being able to say anything. But many people I could actually see having to walk away and say, oh, gee, I have to think about that. But the San Francisco 9/11 truth, we had a very difficult time getting people to accept it. We ended up doing an event on our own, this breakaway faction, which we became known as the Physical Evidence Group. And that led to an email fight within the group, which Mike Rupert got involved in, and he was saying physical evidence is a complete trap, you know, don't go there. And one of his cohorts in the group actually asserted that the laws of physics are broken every day in the laboratory, so it means nothing for us. Yes.
Oh, my
yes.
God.
Yes.
This is based on a colossal misunderstanding, okay? They don't understand. This is, I'm going to say something very technical, Jeff, okay? And I'm not going to elaborate it here, but I will at a certain point. This has got to do with the fact that the laws of physics concern what would happen under very certain, very specific conditions, and frequently they involve idealization, where you're talking about what are known technically as counterfactual conditions, what would have happened if a certain situation had been the case. For example, you get the remarks about the fall of a body from the top of the Twin Towers in a vacuum. Well, there wasn't a vacuum. But if there had been a vacuum, say a bowling ball would have come down in, say, slightly over 9 seconds, right? But, of course, that's not the situation in which the towers were existing. They weren't in the center of enormous bell jars that had all the air sucked out of them. So you got to understand that in order to account for this, you got to take into consideration every factor whose presence or absence made a difference to the occurrence as it took place at that time. There's a technical name for this. It's called the requirement of maximal specificity. Mm-hmm. And it's a necessary condition for law-like statements that would be laws if they were true, to be true. But, you know, it's not terribly well understood, and I think that the remark that you heard there from this assistant to Rupert simply reflects his conceptual confusion about the nature of laws of nature.
Well, and he was asserting that in regards to how fast the towers fell, that somehow it would be possible for them to fall at the rate that they fell, and
solely under the influence of gravity?
Yeah, as if the steel and concrete offered no more resistance than air because, well, laws are broken all the time. I mean, that's such an inane...
Well, I like to draw this parallel with the Eiffel Tower. I mean, the towers were structurally very similar to the Eiffel Tower because their support at the base was massive. It wasn't spread out and distributed the way the Eiffel Tower is spread out and distributed. But would anyone in their wildest imagination imagine that if a plane had hit the top of the Eiffel Tower or if there had been some modest fire at the top of the Eiffel Tower, it would have caused the entire structure to collapse
at
approximately the rate of free fall in a vacuum?
And more than that, to turn to dust while collapsing.
And to turn to dust while collapsing? I mean,
yes.
this is someone who really is incompetent to address the issues.
Rupert eventually just gave way and said, well, you're right, but I still think this is a dead end because they can bring their experts and then they'll match your experts. And, you know, you should stick with my way and then that'll be the only way to prevail. And but in the 2004, in March 2004, there was a series of convergences of the truth movement. For the first time, it was really becoming noticeable that in San Francisco, there were more than 1,000 people at the Davis Center, and then there was a large convergence in Toronto. And the media were actually forced to cover it, if nothing else, to say, look at these people, aren't they strange? But at least to mention us. And in that convergence, there was an interesting transformation. Mike Rupert spoke, and he primarily spoke, of course, about foreknowledge, but actually not even about 9/11. He was starting to move to other topics, such as peak oil, which I totally accept, but I still think that he's really not a good spokesperson for the cause. And then there was Jim Hoffman talking about the WTC, and he got a standing ovation. It was clear that the momentum...
You mean at Berkeley?
This was in San Francisco.
Yeah, go ahead.
And he got a standing ovation from the crowd that had come from all over the place, from all over the world.
What year was this?
This was in March 2004. And you can really see the change that physical evidence was becoming accepted within the movement in spite of the attempts to gatekeep.
I've had a very strange experience with Jim Hoffman. Since Creating Scholars, Hoffman has repeatedly attacked me personally and the society and in published pieces that appeared on his website, and I responded to them and sent them to him for posting, and he chose not to post them, which I found very strange. And my response is I give links to his papers so people can read what he has written about scholars and about me. And the articles that I've written about him in rebuttal which he was unwilling to post, can be found on the scholar's website, st911.org or 911scholars.org. Just go down the article section to the bottom and you'll find a small box. They're very interesting reading. I encourage everyone to take a look. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays and sometimes subbing for me. My special guest today is Jeff Strahl, and we're talking about the history of the 9/11 truth movement. Jeff, I want you to give us a brief recap and pick up.
Okay, so we were at the point where the truth convergences were happening in San Francisco and Toronto in the spring of 2004, and the movement was sort of leaving people like Mike Rupert behind and moving towards much more acceptance of physical evidence, as, for example, people like Jim Hoffman. I remember Daniel Hopsicker, who runs Mad Cow Productions, who was actually one of the first people to raise questions about the nature of the hijackers, who they really worked for, who they were, in a speech at that Truth Convergence, threatened that if he met anybody who said that the planes didn't bring down the WTC or that a plane didn't hit the Pentagon, if he were to meet him in a dark alley, he would do them in. You know, that he, you know, people like that are downright dangerous. There was like a last shot from the rear guard. I mean, we left people like that behind, we thought, except people like John Judge and Kyle Hance, who formed Citizens Watch, seemed to monopolize 9/11 events when they were running them and freezing out people who are raising serious questions.
I had a very odd experience with John Judge. I frequently have appeared on a program where I'm actually listed as a co-host called Black Op Radio. Mm-hmm. And a couple of months ago, John Judge was on talking about the Pentagon, and I came on after him, and I felt his characterization of what happened at the Pentagon was so removed from the facts, and his arguments were so flawed, that it convinced me that he did not have the interest of discovering truth and exposing falsehoods at stake, and I mince no words about it. I've been very troubled by Jim Hoffman's attempts to, on the one hand, minimize the remarks by Larry Silverstein in relation to having the building pulled, which, as a student of syntax, semantics, and pragmatics of the grammar and the meaning of words and the context in which they're used, there can be no doubt about the meaning as having been an instruction to bring it down by controlled demolition. And yet Hoffman has introduced attempt after attempt after attempt to minimize or equivocate or suggest that's not true. And he's also, of course, been working this Pentagon situation as though there was some reason to think that a Boeing 757 actually hit the building when there's no reason whatsoever to believe that. And these kinds of moves by Jim Hoffman have caused me profound concern, and John Judge, too.
Well, yeah, an interesting story on Hoffman in a minute. But as far as John Judge claimed that a friend of his, a fellow researcher, went to the Pentagon a couple of days after, and she saw the tail on the lawn, and she recognized it as the plane of Flight 77.
She saw the tail on the lawn?
Yeah.
So why didn't people point out the photographs of the guy's green, beautifully mowed? You know, I expect Tiger Woods to show up with his caddy and start practicing his putting.
Yeah, well, then people pointed out the lack of any evidence of a tail, which is a pretty large piece. And then she said, well, she saw the inside the building, except that the hall was only 25 feet high. The tail is 45 feet, 44 feet.
44 feet from the ground, sure.
Yeah, so there's no way it could have happened, but he continues to claim that. Well, in the meantime, there's more interesting work with physical evidence. Dave Heller, a Bay Area researcher, came up with an idea that I eventually called the resistance paradox. I gave it a title. He came up with the idea that you couldn't have the building, the WTC buildings, collapsing in as short a time as they did, which would show no resistance, and yet at the same time have the building being shredded into dust, which would indicate encountering high resistance. If you are accepting the notion that the buildings just fell because of the fires, you'd have to posit both high resistance and low resistance at the same time to the fall, and that's a complete physical impossibility. Nobody that I know of has been able to contradict that. None of my engineering students, at the very least. Nobody I know, that I know of. But about that time also, Jim Huffman, who had advanced the notion of a maser being used to bring down the WTC, this would be an equivalent of the a microwave equivalent of the laser. He did so on Bonnie Faulkner's show Guns and Butter in 2004. But shortly after that, and this was shortly after he got together with a woman named Victoria Ashley, he started changing his tune about the Pentagon, and he was saying this, the funniest stuff, such as, for example, well, the planes actually did hit stuff on the ground, but then people ran out from the Pentagon and put it back up in order to make it look like a plane didn't hit. And yes, he was saying the most, and people couldn't believe it, but he actually staged a confrontation at a meeting of the San Francisco Physical Evidence Group, and he got us to drop the Pentagon from a program that we were planning to do in November 2004, which caused me to quit. I mean, this was an outrageous act of censorship, I thought. And since then, he and Victoria Ashley are all over the Internet as soon as anybody posts and telling people, oh, don't go to that site, don't listen to this person. This person is, is completely irreputable. At the 9/11 2004, this was supposed to be a conference in New York. Nick Leavis and Kyle Hentz try to prevent physical evidence people from talking, but they failed. This was still another act of censorship. In the meantime, we also had the appearance of Kevin Ryan, who worked for Underwriters Laboratories, who came up with some very interesting information about the temperature of the fires that,
yes,
that hit the WTC.
I always thought Kevin Ryan was a very noble fellow and that he'd done good things here and that, you know, being fired gave him a distinctive status.
And about that time, the media really started taking things so seriously that Popular Mechanics was commissioned to do a hit job on the 9/11 truth. And then Scientific American jumped into the act. But their articles were shredded, I mean, by people writing responses, both Jim Huffman as well as Peter Mayer in Serendipity. I mean, even to the point that they misstated what had been said about the WTC. But also about that time, Ward Churchill, who is a well-known leftist intellectual at the University of Colorado, got in trouble for making remarks about how the people at the WTC were Eichmann's
little Eichmanns.
And then,
what he meant by that, however, Jeff, as you may well appreciate, is simply that they were like those who are sometimes described as the good Germans during World War II. You know, they were supportive of the military-industrial complex. He wasn't specifically implying they were out to gas the Jews, for example. He was saying that they were, you know, simply being accepting and supportive of the military-industrial intelligence complex.
I understand, but that wasn't actually the point, because it wasn't that got me. But somebody asked him, at an appearance in San Francisco, somebody said, oh, the people who are trying to fire you are the same ones who carried out 9/11. And his response to that was that anybody who claims that 19 Muslim hijackers didn't carry out 9/11 and brought down the towers is basically racist, making it seem like...
He was endorsing the government's account.
Yes, because people would say otherwise.
Stand by, Jeff. We'll be back with my special guest, Jeff Straw. We're talking about the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement. This is your host, Jim Fetzer. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, who you can hear on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me, with my special guest today, Jeff Straw, who's reviewing the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Jeff, what you've been telling us is really quite fascinating. I'm stunned by your detailed, virtually encyclopedic knowledge of these things, and I want to just invite you to continue.
Okay. Well, thank you. I lived it, so I remember. Well, we were at war. Churchill declaring that anybody who questions the official story is a racist, because then they make Third World people unable to do what happened on 9/11. And a friend of mine, Jack Stroh, was driven to write an article titled "Left Denial on 9/11 Turns Irrational," because basically about how this is. Denial is now taking the shape of calling people racist simply because they're questioning the physical possibility of the official story. As if anybody could do that. America,
how can that be racist? I mean, you know, the principles of physics are completely independent of anybody's personality, background, race, religion, sex. I mean, this is such an absurd claim, it's difficult to imagine anyone could take it seriously.
And simultaneously, Noam Chomsky came up with a gem where he was claiming that the laws of physics are, you ready, violated every day in the laboratory.
Noam Chomsky has been such a disappointment to me. I not only have serious, I'm not only stupefied by his stance about JFK, where he maintains that he doesn't see that there could have been a high-level plot to take out Jack because he doesn't think there were any serious policy issues involved, completely oblivious of Jack's intention to cut the oil depletion allowance to dismantle the CIA, to keep America from invading Cuba, to sign an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, to pull our forces out of Vietnam, the list goes on, and the man just has his head buried in the sand like an ostrich. And then when it comes to 9/11, it's completely outrageous. I would be very pleased to have a public debate with Noam Chomsky.
Chomsky basically evoked quantum theory to try to explain what happened at the WTC, when quantum theory only deals with subatomic particles. So I think, yeah, that's pretty marvelous.
That's pitiful.
Yeah. And at the same time, John Judge came out and said that anybody who now says that the WTC was subject to demolition was a government agent, and people should stay away from that. So
This is so very bad, Jeff. It's just, it's a tragedy of betrayal.
And then Mike Rupert at the same time said, oh, let's just forget 9/11. We have to go on to other things. I mean, if you persist on researching 9/11, you're looking at the elephant that just went by, not noticing the herd that's coming, and then illustrated it with a photo of a single elephant versus a photo of a herd, as if people didn't get his point. That was as deep as he got. But then we had an interesting addition of Morgan Reynolds, a former top official with the U.S. Labor Department in George Bush's first term, who came out and started calling the official story into question. This was May 2005, which is an interesting development. And this was shortly followed by a group of people that got together. Marcus Ford originally had the idea, but then other people got together with the notion of writing a book from an academic perspective about September 11th. David Ray Griffin at this point had already put out two very interesting books, one of them, The New Pearl Harbor, and another one about the 9/11 Commission, which was a complete atrocity on any kind of notion of inquiry. So we're thinking we're going to put out a book with articles questioning different aspects of the story. And about that time also, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology came up with an official report trying to explain what happened at the World Trade Center, and they got caught in severe lies, such as, for example, the body of the report saying that the temperatures of the fires, that none of the steel samples they examined exceeded 600 degrees centigrade, and in fact 99% of them did not exceed 250 degrees centigrade, where steel doesn't even seriously weaken until over 600 degrees centigrade. But then, in a conclusion, they said the fires must have gotten hot enough to cause structural damage because the buildings fell. So in other words, the buildings are brought down by fires, and fires were hot enough because the buildings fell.
A nice example of begging the question.
That's an example of circular thinking,
Circular
reasoning. They would have gotten you an F in the freshman science class.
That's right, or critical thinking.
Yes. And just about that time, as we were trying to get the volume together, Stephen Jones, a physics professor from Brigham Young University in Utah, all of a sudden came out of the woodworks, wrote a letter to his colleagues that he'd been persuaded that there was something wrong with the official story. So he was recruited to write a chapter for the book about 9/11. It turned out at the end he pulled out because he said the university was giving him trouble, and David Ray Griffin instead contributed a chapter about the WTC collapses. Of course, the Pentagon wasn't mentioned. There were people on that group who seriously resisted having any physical evidence mentioned. This is 4 years after 9/11, and they're still resisting physical inquiry. So, particularly Nafiz Ahmed, who has written several books about 9/11, but these are always about the CIA connections of the quote-unquote hijackers. He was even asserting at one point that the planes were necessary in order to ignite the explosives that brought down the WTC, which didn't make any sense. He was arguing strenuously against David Griffin's chapter in the book about the events of 9/11 that actually came out last year, because he was saying that it would question our credibility. I mean, people would question our credibility if they were to read that, because it wasn't supported fully by facts. But we kind of ignored him on that, luckily. At about that time also, a woman by the name of Judy Wood, who is a professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson, became visible. Well, she first posted this stuff at Democratic Underground, which is a website where people post all sorts of stuff. And then she joined a group that was formed about that time by you, the Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and wrote a very interesting article about the what she called the billiard ball example, which was a thought experiment proving that the towers could not have collapsed in a time observed unless there was demolition. That led to some increasing controversy within the scholars group between Stephen Jones and Judy Wood, which I really didn't understand why their work was being attacked with the notion that somehow it was undermining the work of Stephen Jones when it wasn't doing so at all.
Of course not. And in fact, it's so simple and so elegant and so straightforward, I think practically anyone could understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So I've always felt it was among the most powerful of all of our proofs that the government's account can't possibly be correct.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. When Stephen Jones first arrived on the scene, he basically just restated many of the ideas that have been kicked around for several years. It wasn't until last year, until 2006, that he started focusing on the notion that thermite was the method that was used to bring down the towers. So, you know, and from that point on, he's basically stopped giving credit to the people who came before him. I don't exactly know what happened.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Jeff Strahl, discussing the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me. My special guest today is Jeff Strahl, discussing the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Jeff, let me interject a question before you continue and bring things up to date.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, you know, the time of the organization of scholars, which I founded in mid-December. You may have been part of the group that I was engaged in discussion when I suggested the creation of a society as a kind of loose affiliation among us. And, of course, a couple members of that group expressed a very vigorous dissent that they didn't want someone else speaking for them as though it were to constrain their freedom of speech. Do you know of anyone else who had proposed a society before then? The suggestion has been made to me that Marcus Ford had this idea, but from what I infer from what you said, he had a plan for a book as opposed to a society. Can you clarify this?
Yeah, his plan was for a book, which he eventually, he gathered this group together, and then he said that he actually didn't have enough time to pursue it, which is why Paul Zaremka took over as more or less a coordinator of the project instead of him. So he didn't have an idea of actually creating an organization. And I was one of those people who expressed reservations about having an organization.
Isn't this ironic?
Mm, yeah. Well, I just have had very bad experiences with organizations, as I've been mentioning. Well, such as, for example, San Francisco 9/11 Truth, which kicked me out after that whole escapade with Rupert opposing physical evidence. I was kicked out for basically causing people to react with ad hominems. I didn't use an ad hominem. Somebody started using ad hominems on me, and before I knew it, I was being expelled for making that nice person resort to ad hominems, which was just pretty incredible. So I just felt, and then the experience with the San Francisco Physical Evidence Group and the takeover by Jim Hoffman, I just had a distrust of groups, and my politics have, for several decades, have tended towards the anarchist variety, so...
Well, tell me what's been going on then this year, since you brought us, I think, right into 2006.
Right. Well, in 2006, we had the emergence of a video called The Loose Change, which I think was a dramatic break into the public arena. It apparently is now the most downloaded video in the history of the Internet. And people I never suspected before asking me about 9/11 and what I thought about loose change. And I found that very surprising. And in May, the government released supposed video of the Pentagon and supposedly showing a plane hitting it, except what they're showing is a smoke trail. What they're showing and claiming was the plane, upon close inspection, turned out to be a smoke trail.
Which I believe actually is a smoke trail from a missile being fired by a smaller plane, a much smaller plane than a Boeing 757 into the Pentagon, prior to the plane hitting the building.
A jet does not leave a vapor trail, certainly not at sea level, certainly not with the air temperature close to 70 degrees.
Nice points, Jeff, nice points. Not to mention the fact that it's not even aerodynamically possible for a big plane like a 757 to just barely skim the ground at 500 miles an hour.
Not to mention the fact that the smoke trail was twisted like a pretzel, and I've never seen a plane like that. I sure wouldn't board one if I saw one at an airport. But that didn't prevent Mike Rupert within a week from from posting an article saying what a bunch of idiots all the physical evidence people were now disclosed to be. You know, since they were so discredited by this one video, and they're claiming that, see, I told you to stay away from the physical.
Well, you know how I'm reminded of a remark attributed to Donald Rumsfeld, that there's a difference between that absence of evidence isn't evidence. The absence, which you could apply in a crime scene, just because somebody's DNA isn't there at the crime scene, or their blood or their footprints, doesn't mean they weren't there. But there are plenty of cases where absence of evidence is evidence of absence. If I say to you there's a pink elephant in your living room, and you go in there and you look around and you come back, Jim, I don't see any evidence of a pink elephant, that absence of evidence is evidence of absence. And certainly in the case of these photographs, a Boeing 757, which is more than twice as long as the Pentagon is tall, would have been conspicuous in the video had the plane been present.
Precisely. Even Bill O'Reilly was not convinced. I mean, somebody is way out there in the right field as Bill O'Reilly saying, I didn't see a plane here. Remarkable that Rupert thought there was a refutation of the physical evidence.
I know, and I gather Jim Hoffman's been peddling that we shouldn't go to the Pentagon because the Pentagon is going to spring a new video that's going to show it was there.
Exactly.
To which I respond, if they had a video that showed it was there, it would have long since surfaced publicly. And the fact that they're suppressing most of the 84 videos shows that it most certainly was not a Boeing 757.
He's been busy with trying to debunk people who claim no 757. He's also gone all over the place. Him and Victoria Ashley. He and Victoria Ashley have been all over the Internet attacking people who question what kind of planes hit the WTC. There's a tremendous amount of information that there's something wrong with the notion of hijacked airliners hitting the WTC because the tail numbers of the plane. Two of the planes that were supposedly used on 9/11, they were still registered as of 2003. This was disclosed quite accidentally, in one case, by some nerd who writes down the tail number of every plane that he flies and posts it on his website. He's not a 9/11 researcher at all.
No, you're right. Two of the planes weren't deregistered by the FAA until 2002, and the other two not until 2005.
Exactly. But he was saying this was just false information planted in order to divert people, even though this was completely arrived at completely accidentally that people came upon that evidence.
You know, I've seen a graph, Jeff, that showed that, you know, the number of hits by the media, the number of stories having to do with 9/11 by the media was virtually a flat line until December of 2005, and then it started gradually to grow. And I'm inclined to think that there was an interaction here going on between loose change, which was becoming, as you describe it, this cultural phenomenon, mm-hmm. downloaded more than 10 million times off of the internet, and the emergence of an organization of some repute, namely the Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And we started putting out press releases and speaking out and you know, making an impact. And then I think the culmination came when after the American Scholars Conference organized by Alex Jones, where four members of Scholars participated in the panel discussion, namely Steve Jones, Bob Bowman, Webster Tarpley, and myself. When C-SPAN finally broadcast that, it seemed to me it shattered the stigma of talking about 9/11. It legitimated discussion, public discussion of those events. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where the Boy Wonder can be heard Mondays, Fridays, and often subbing for me in between, with my special guest, Jeff Strahl. Jeff, for talking about the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement, we've come into the year 2006. I was observing that it seemed to me that three major factors made a difference this year, and that it was reflected in a dramatic increase in the number of articles that began to appear in the mass media and elsewhere, namely the downloading some 10 million times of the video DVD Loose Change, the emergence of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and then the C-SPAN broadcasting the panel discussion from the American Scholars Conference, which it seems to me legitimated public discussion of 9/11, and that matters haven't been the same since.
Correct. Oh, by the way, before I forget, excellent choice of music. About the summer of 2006, we also had the appearance of an opinion poll by Ohio University Scripps Howard to the effect that more than one in three Americans thought the U.S. government either knew about 9/11 ahead of time or actually aided it. One in six thought the WTC towers were brought down by demolition, and about 12% believed that a 757 did not hit the Pentagon. And you might say those are small numbers, but those are huge numbers given the complete lack of media coverage.
And, of course, a more recent poll by the New York Times and CBS has shown 53% of the American people question what the government has told them about 9/11, 28% more rejected altogether, mm-hmm. and only 16% accept what the 9/11 Commission claims to be the truth about 9/11.
Right. Big question is what they'll do about it, but for that I guess we'll have to wait and see. In the meantime, Chomsky came out and recently stating that the one in the three people who are skeptical, that shows that's actually a terrible sign of how cynical the American public is to think that the U.S. government would do something like that. So the same gatekeepers keep appearing over and over again. Likewise with Jim Hoffman. Likewise with another fellow, name of Alex Sloan, who was in that Jeff King's WTC list, which then grew on to other topics and became sort of informally Scientists for Truth and Justice. He was actually raising the notion that we should find it's okay to look at WTC, but don't talk about that in public. It's better to stick to things like stand down that we can more easily prove, because people will turn off as soon as we start talking about the physical evidence. He got a strenuous counter-argument, needless to say, from the other members of the list.
This was Sloan's argument?
Right.
So it's picking up Michael Rupert's theme?
Mm-hmm.
That's quite bizarre.
And he quickly retreated on that and eventually even took part in putting together a brochure that some of our people handed out at the 9/11-2004 convergence in New York. But before that, he was actually putting forth the argument that we should stick to stand down and foreknowledge and things that are easily provable, as if the physical evidence doesn't involve very simple laws of physics. And that brought us to summer of 2006 with increasingly nasty arguments, it appeared to me, within the scholars between people who were completely adhering to Professor Jones and people who were open to Judy Wood's arguments as well. And the people arguing against Professor Wood were often arguing with the idea that this would what she's advancing would discredit the movement. It's the same old theme that we started getting on September.
It's simply absurd, as I explained on the program Tuesday when I interviewed her and Morgan Reynolds, and I'd invited Steve Jones to appear, but he was a no-show. Judy appears to me to be the single most qualified individual to ever study the case. She has degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and material structure science. Nothing could be more relevant. Steve has a background in physics, but it's far removed in general, his work on this cold fusion, for example, not to mention his contributions to archaeometry.
Mm-hmm.
They don't provide much of a basis here, and it seems to me, when you look seriously at Steve's work, that there are a lot of questions that arise as to whether or not he has even conducted a suitable literature search before he initiated his hypothesis, done a suitable establishment of the concept, the very proof of concept that it could actually do what it's supposed to do. In fact, he now has admitted that he knows of no instance in which thermite have been used to bring about the demolition of a building. To me, that's quite shocking.
Exactly. And the argument that Judy Wood advanced regarding the seismic evidence, the fact that the seismic signals created by the collapses of the towers were much smaller than you'd expect, given the comparison of the potential energy of the towers in comparison to the Seattle Kingdom, which was brought down in 2000 by demolition and created a signal of 2.3, same or even slightly bigger than the towers, even though the towers had much more energy. And nobody's been able to explain it. Some people have asserted that there are alternative explanations, but have not advanced them. I brought this up to Stephen Jones at a conference that was held at UC Berkeley 2 months ago, and he basically failed to answer the question. At first he said that there was no evidence of what she was advancing, and then I pointed out that there was plenty of calculations at the site, and I said, well, I haven't seen them. I mean, first of all, how would he know if he...
How can anyone maintain that their explanation is the most reasonable one if you don't compare it with the alternatives? And this is a matter of being unwilling to confront the alternatives. I mean, he's written some about mini nukes, but that's not as serious as considering the full range of directed energy weapons, the possibility of HAARP, maybe solar energy. Now, this is interesting. That's an area where Steve Jones actually has some expertise. He ought to be acknowledging that solar energy is without question a potential possible source that could have been exploited for the sake of destroying the towers and destroying the whole World Trade Center. In fact, the devastation is so massive, even if his explanation were good as gold for the Twin Towers, it wouldn't account for what happened to WTC-3, WTC-4, WTC-5, WTC-6.
I have a different explanation yet, I mean, which is regarding the possible use of acoustic energy. And energy is a matter of waves. The destruction caused by a bomb is because of the shock waves. And some very low frequency sound signals have been known to be capable of doing damage. There was a case where Phil Esch, bassist for the Grateful Dead, was actually practicing at a time, and he hit a note that caused a chunk of the Winterland Arena in San Francisco to fall down and almost hit David Crosby, who was sitting there just
And you know, Jeff,
you know,
this is part and parcel. When I had Bob Bowman on the show here very recently, I was pressing him, you know, about the development of space-based weaponry, because that's part and parcel of the Air Force's desire for what is called full-spectrum dominance, not just land, sea, and air, land, and sea, but space as well. And, of course, the neocons have been hugely aggressive about this. Yeah, I discovered when I was doing research on the death of Paul Wellstone, where all the evidence indicated that some kind of directed energy weapon had been used to overwhelm the electrical system and flip these solenoids that controlled the pitch of the props and put them on idle to bring the plane down. I discovered that there was a directed energy professional society that was that year, which would have been 2004, having its 10th annual professional meeting in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back with my special guest. This is the Dynamic Duo with Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetcher, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally Sobbing for Me. We're rapidly concluding 2 hours of fascinating discussion about the history of the 9/11 Truth Movement with Jeff Strahl. Jeff, I'd like to turn the mic over to you to give us kind of a summary of where things stand and what you think people need to grasp or appreciate about where we are today.
Well, yeah, it has been a long, strange trip, hasn't it? I wanted just a few concluding remarks about Stephen Jones, that when I confronted him about the fact that he had just contradicted himself, first saying that the site had no calculations regarding the seismic evidence, and then saying that he hadn't seen it yet, his reaction was, well, Judy Wood is one of those no-plane people, and so you shouldn't pay attention to anything she says anyway.
And, of course, that isn't Judy's position. She hasn't actually declared a position about planes or no planes of the World Trade Center. But suppose she had. What would that have to do with her points in other areas? It would be completely irrelevant.
Exactly.
She could be right on some points and wrong on others, and to fail to reply to points she's making in one area because of concerns you have about another is an evasion.
Exactly. And, of course, he got an ovation from Jim Hoffman and Victoria Ashley, who promptly led the cheering. I mean, the event was extremely staged in that way. And since then, they've been out patrolling the Internet, posting about how this you shouldn't go to this site and you shouldn't go to that site and you shouldn't believe these people and et cetera, and you shouldn't read this stuff. My conclusion is I think people, given the history of gatekeeping that's been going on, the last thing people should do is use lines like, oh, this will discredit the movement if we talk about it. There was one of the greatest pieces of graffiti from May 68 in Paris, I thought, was, it is forbidden to forbid. And I think that should really be one of our mottos in the 9/11 Truth Movement. If we're after truth, we should be open to all sorts of things. It doesn't mean that everything that gets raised gets an immediate acceptance. People should hold everything to question, especially strange theories like thermite was capable of turning buildings to dust, concrete and steel and all, and burn and scorching all sorts of cars with very weird scorch marks. I mean, that's a totally strange theory that I think people should definitely question.
Jeff, I wonder if you would share this opinion. I mean, it seems to me the kind of protective belt that people like Alex Flom and Carl Weiss and Fred Burks have thrown up around Steve's work, attempting to protect it from criticism, really displays the characteristics of a cult. It's as though we're dealing here with religious dogma, not scientific hypotheses.
Exactly. It's a matter, I think, of a group that has found itself becoming an interest group, pushing for a particular point of view, and then trying to use this position to dominate and eliminate all competition, instead of just becoming just one idea that's being advanced. And if it's strong enough,
it doesn't
have to.
I dare say this is a completely unscientific attitude. I mean, I explained in the interview with Judy and Morgan why I believe Steve's research has run out of gas, that it's what's known technically as a degenerating research program, because it isn't spawning new ideas, new publications, new efforts, new experiments, new observations. It seems to me it's basically petered out.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to understand what happened on 9/11, I'm afraid we're going to have to look elsewhere. I mean, the probability of the massive effects that you've been describing being brought about by thermite is approximately zero.
Exactly. And as I said, I have my favorite explanation. At this point, I wouldn't want to elaborate too much on it because I have to do my own research and to clarify exactly what were the means used to create such possible sonic waves. I really don't know, but I still don't think that people should laugh that off the chart just because it seems bizarre. It's no more. I think what's bizarre is the idea that conventional explosives and thermite are capable of reducing gigantic buildings to dust. I mean, Jim Hoffman's own calculations for several years ago showed that that was pretty impossible, and that's why he advanced the notion of a maser, the microwave equivalent of a laser being used. And now he's taking part in the attempted lynching of anybody who, well, at least the theoretical lynching of anybody who advances such notions. I think that that's a very strange twist of fate. But I think we do need to look to new places for answers, and I think we ought not to be afraid of the of notions of examining what planes were used, or the idea that the passenger lists were faked, or also the idea that the cell phone calls were faked. I think everything ought to be examined and subjected to serious questioning. I mean, after all, isn't that what we've been doing with the official story from day one? And we've been told we shouldn't be doing that.
I know, Jeff.
One?
It's absurd, you know, when they say, "Well, we start talking about that, people aren't going to take us seriously because it's controversial." When everything we've been doing from scratch has been controversial. If we're not willing to engage in controversial subject, we ought to get out of the 9/11 research business.
On 9/11, if you even said that the U.S. government had something to do with, even accepting the notion that this was an attack, that somehow U.S. policies were responsible for it, you were labeled a traitor and not tolerated. So for people to live through that and then at some point further on in the future declare, okay, this is as far as we should go, we shouldn't question anything beyond that, I think is really blows my mind.
So this group that calls themselves Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice really is forming a protective belt around Steve Jones' research, not allowing it to be subjected to serious criticism and seeking to undermine and attack those who question it, when I think any objective assessment leads to the conclusion that it was not founded upon a suitable literature search, that there is no appropriate proof of concept, and that it cannot possibly explain what it's intended or advanced to explain. Now, to me, to try to protect a faulty program like that is completely and utterly contrary to the objectives of discovering truth and exposing falsehoods.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. It's as if this group has become more dedicated to protecting its turf.
So it just shocks me, Jeff, how many attacks have been launched against me and Judy and Morgan merely because we want to open up the full range of alternative possible explanations, because we want to emphasize the degree of devastation to the World Trade Center as a totality, to consider the mass of those buildings at 500,000 tons apiece in relation to the failure to completely destroy the functional integrity of the bathtub, not to mention the toasted cars. I mean, we got a fascinating problem here to figure out, and there's no way that if we prematurely fixate on some hopelessly inadequate approach like thermite, we will ever be able to accomplish the task.
And I've already seen different sites within defenders of the official story already discounting the thermite explanation. It's as if this... I mean, if they were setting us a trap to walk into by a full embrace of thermite, they couldn't have done a better job, it seems like.
That bothers me profoundly, Jeff. I think you're exactly right. It's as though we were being led down a primrose path. And Judy has pointed out to me that NIST has already considered and rejected thermite as a possible cause of the demolition of the buildings, which hints that they're in the position to pull the carpet out from under us anytime they choose, if indeed we are putting all our eggs in the thermite basket.
Recently, I've had an email discussion with some of them, and they propose that there is a device on which there is a patent, not any evidence that has been used, to inject thermite in a certain direction so as to enable it to make horizontal cut through steel.
I think actually, didn't Steve point that out to you in an email exchange,
right,
that I have disseminated to the membership in relation to this latest effort to subvert us, that the patent only allows to cut 2 inches of steel, so he responded to cut 4, they just have to put 1 on each side?
And how would they attach that?
Jeff,
it's
been great. I can't thank you enough for coming on. You're an encyclopedia of knowledge about 9/11 truth, and you made a wonderful guest on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thanks for listening.
No.